Welcome to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. This podcast is all about conversations about healing and rising from the ashes of your grief and trauma. In this podcast, we will be deconstructing and highlighting the different aspects of grief and loss. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Zampatella. So that leads me to a question of, like, if you've got a family that's involved in the care of somebody who's dying, mm-hmm. and then they don't think that they're getting what they should, but they're getting everything that mm-hmm. is available to them, mm-hmm. and they come to you and they go, I just don't feel like we're getting enough of the nurse needs to come more often, mm-hmm. or the other caregiver needs to come more often, or clergy needs to come more often, whatever, mm-hmm. Because we just don't feel like you guys are treating us well. Mm-hmm. Then what?
So we will try our best to, like, adjust and meet their needs. Okay. However, sometimes there may be extenuating needs of unmanaged symptoms with the patient, mm-hmm. That is a different – let me back up. Sometimes there's a misconception that hospice is around 24/7. We're not.
Yes, that's exactly where I'm going with that. Okay.
We are not around 24/7. We will be there coming, like, scheduled visits, but we will not provide around the clock unless you qualify for continuous care or inpatient hospice, which is the result of unmanaged symptoms at the end of life. They can't get these things under control.
Continuous care.
Continuous care would be 24/7, more involved. Hospice in itself is usually, like, we're coming, once a day. People sometimes have this idea that once they sign hospice, our house, we might have, like, care 24/7. Right. No, that's not what it's like, unless you have such severe unmanaged symptoms that, A, this hospice would have to have the staff to do continuous care in the home. They then might, if they don't put you, like, in a skilled nursing facility with, like, where you can get that care.
Right.
Or there's inpatient hospices in themselves. However, they are rapidly closing because, if we're going to be honest, like, it's hard to fill the beds, the turnover, and the government. Like, it's just not fine. Even though it would be amazing for all, because what it's done for families to be there, to have that 24/7 support.
Yeah.
It's not financially feasible based upon... Because
people are coming across this and they don't understand.
Yeah.
And it's not like freedom of speech.
Yeah.
Hey, lady, that's what we got.
From the government.
So government is shutting down, like, hospice organizations where people can go into the hospice.
The hospices are choosing to close because they aren't making, like,
it can't financially be sustained.
Yes.
So can't pay your salary. Mm-hmm. So they're shutting it down. Mm-hmm. That sucks.
Yeah, it does.
What do we do with that?
That's the question.
Oh, I don't know. Now I got something to talk to somebody about. that's amazing to me. Okay, so then they amp up for more intensive care. Mm-hmm. At that point, does that mean more people are in the home, or they have mm-hmm. to be taken out of the home and put into a skilled nursing facility or a hospital?
So if we're able to if the hospice is able to do a continuous care, like, we have enough staff, mm-hmm. we will do that. Okay. And then that's its own separate thing that we deal with Medicare. If we don't have the staff, that's when it might be then where we look for an inpatient hospice.
I hate that this is tied into money.
Tell me all.
Yeah. I mean, I just hate that it's tied into money.
I mean, I don't want to say that. No, I do. I'm going to say it. Working for a small local hospice versus chain hospices, you see the difference in quality of care. The smaller hospices tend to value smaller patient caseloads for the nurses. So they have more mm-hmm. time and quality, like, to be able to be present. There's kind of a death industry feeling going on of where we're getting bought out. The small people are getting bought out. We see it happening in our healthcare systems as a whole. Everyone, the big guys are buying all the small guys out. And in turn, it's also happening in hospice. And so there's this big push for quotas of how many people you're going to have on your census, how to meet the census, how much money you get reimbursed based on diagnosis. Like, things are changing in a weird field where it becomes more about the death industry from profits, some non-for-profits, hospices. How do you have a profit hospice that is... But that just is another story. But
that's an important part of the story. Yeah. Like, because, I mean, if we're not, if people don't understand what's happening behind the scenes, right. You know what I mean? And they're frustrated. Like, I knew somebody who their loved one was sent home on hospice, mm-hmm. and nobody spent any time mm-hmm. teaching her what to do. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, when he does this, what am I supposed to do? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. He's making this face, and I don't know if that means I'm supposed to be doing something else. And this constant, and again, we'll talk about this when we do the caregiving, but mm-hmm. this constantly questioning whether or not they have the skills in order to be able to provide mm-hmm. that good death. Mm-hmm. And then the guilt, you know, that happens, you know. And so is that the responsibility of the hospice, yes. to teach the caregiver? And then, okay, so why isn't that happening?
Probably because
of money.
The caseloads are too high. There's not an ability to.
Oh my God. My God.
I mean, I've seen it like in action, you know, it's a fine line between where they're trying to do their budget with staffing and then addressing the needs, right?
And like, in the meantime, I've got clients that are coming in mm-hmm. distressed, and it's not just grief, but I mean, we're talking about, you know, the impact on self-esteem mm-hmm. and whether or not I have loved that person or not. And mm-hmm. if I loved them enough, I would have figured it out. Maybe I could have done some research. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, this bullshit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. This organization, which by the mm-hmm. way, we pay taxes mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. taxes are supposed to pay for mm-hmm. this. And then we've got people who are in charge of this money who've mm-hmm. decided that that's not what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. We're going to put it into like some system. Mm-hmm. So, oh my gosh, I'm getting all fired up over the hospice. And I know that the people who work at the hospice don't want this to happen. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. So it comes out on you guys when you're like, I'm in this job because I'm really trying to make sure mm-hmm. that people are getting their needs met. Mm-hmm. And yet I've got this, you know, mm-hmm. whoever is, you know, in charge of the hospice, a president, I don't know,
trust board, well, it depends.
The director of the hospice or whatever coming down, who also has information coming down going, no, you need to do this. Mm-hmm. Like, that can't feel good.
No.
And that's the reason why you're here, right?
That's exactly why
you ended up here.
Because
you guys got bought out by a bigger company mm-hmm. and they wanted to do it in a shitty way. Mm-hmm. And you're like, that's not in line with how I understand myself in the world and why I'm in this field. And I better find something else. And then you ended up on Indeed. And found me, and I was so friggin' happy, and now you can, you know, which by the way, we should probably talk about, I don't know,
I can speak, like, I questioned what the bottom line was when I was in a hospice small that got bought out mm-hmm. and by a big chain.
And nobody telling you.
Right.
That was
very last minute, very hush hush. And then not being able to provide bereavement support in ways that I considered ethical.
Right.
Like
confidentiality issues?
Yes. Yeah. Where it's more like a call center and everyone can hear like your conversation. Like, oh, no one my wants God. To hear that. Like, people laughing in the background while you're talking about your loved one. Yep. So if you're not cultivating a space
for bereavement, what is that saying? Is a reflection of how you value your
family members. Yeah. Are you just looking at the patients as money, or you know, because the bereaved
lose the humanity.
Yeah, it's why I ultimately ended up here, because the direction that I saw things going in, I just couldn't find myself falling in line like with the unethical yeah. ways that bereavement and honestly social work, seeing the strain that they're putting on their staff mm-hmm. and how that then in turn, as you've touched, affects the families, mm-hmm. there's a problem in the system that needs to be addressed.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
One of the things that I don't think we've touched on is even just when it comes to people dying in the hospital, the differences between hospice care and children's palliative care. A child can die in the hospital, as we were touching on, like continuous care and the differences between that. And they're allowed to die in the hospital under that age bracket of 21 because that doesn't affect the statistic rates or the mortality rates for the hospital. However, if that individual is over that age, the hospital will make an effort to get them discharged, to get them where they need to be, because that impacts their mortality.
Oh my God.
Rates.
I'm going to like throw up in my mouth a little bit.
But then you have someone that is dying actively in transport, which is what we don't want. So there's so many things in conjunction that we try to address, but you're battling a lot of systems. So it's like hospice comes from the origins of volunteerism. The word means hospitality. Like that's why we have volunteers as part. They're supposed to meet 5% of the patient clinical hours with volunteer hours because that's what we're embedded in.
Oh.
Yeah. So losing the roots of that is concerning to me, which is why many of us go into it because that resonates with us.
That's
right?
Where your career was, you know, aiming towards that. You know, every time you're talking about, you know, the dying in the hospital, my grandmother, my ornery Italian American grandmother, she ended up getting cancer several times in her life. One thing that was interesting is I went into her refrigerator one time and there was a kit.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know where I'm going with this? It was a kit that had morphine in it. Mm-hmm.
Comfort kit.
That's it. Thank you. I couldn't remember the name of it to save my life. A comfort kit that they were telling her how to use. Mm-hmm. And the way that she took it, I'm not saying it was definitely the way that it was said, but the way she took it was like, if it gets too bad, you have access to as much of this morphine as you want. Kind of like you can take your own life.
Mm-hmm.
That's how she had it in her mind. That's how she took it.
And we've had in the past patients that have signed up for hospice took all their comfort medications thinking that it was like physician-assisted suicide.
Right, exactly.
And woke up pissed off that they're still alive.
Yeah.
Literally calling the hospice pissed off.
Wait, you told me that this is what, you know, that meant. And so in her mind, that's what that meant. That's how she interpreted that.
When really, like, the comfort kit is meant, so we call it like the Hulk. Right, like you want to keep the Hulk from appearing pain, and all these symptoms can be slowly. You start to feel pain a little bit. Take the medicine then, because once it becomes so big, it's so hard to get it managed back down. However, we also have run into instances where in hospice, like substance abuse may run in, that we have lock boxes. Like we've had to run into those issues, sadly, where families have taken their loved ones, their dying loved ones' medication that is meant to make them comfortable and sold them on the streets.
Wow.
I don't know if you need to include that.
No, but like, it. No, this is, I mean,
it's an ethical dilemma. It's an ethical dilemma we come to in a hospice, because then it's like, does the medical director put their license on the line to provide more comfort meds that might then be put on the streets?
Yeah.
Because these are, as you mentioned, morphine. I mean, these aren't light medications. Yeah. And if you're not administering them in the way that they're prescribed.
Right. They can be fatal. Mm-hmm. So then there was this other part with my grandmom that I went to the hospital. At this point, her cancer had progressed. And she was in the hospital and they had her on morphine and she really wasn't responsive. My great aunts, who I've got stories about them, oh my goodness, but you know, they were there very upset, understandably. They're, you know, obviously upset. So I go up there to visit my grandmom. She was in Trenton, and I mean, she wasn't my grandmother. She was dying and she wasn't coming back, you know. And I have feelings about that. I have feelings about the fact that basically, we are allowing people to die, but they have to go through this period where they may be suffering, and we know that death is inevitable, and they don't have a right to make that choice about, I don't know if I want to die a natural death because I'm not coming back, and I'm, you know, I mean, we do that with our animal. Anyway, so she wasn't interacting with anybody, and this nurse comes in, this male nurse, and he's messing with her pillows, and you know, she's kind of just moving along with the pillows. And I went over there and I said, I got it. And I had no idea what the hell I was doing, but I'm like, I got it. And so I went down into her ear and I said, he doesn't know what the fuck he's doing, does he? And she goes, and she laughed. And my aunt's like, what did you say to her? And I was like, I doesn't. This is what I said to her after the nurse left the room. And they're like, oh my God, you know, she heard. So, you know, you don't know what they're hearing. You know,
oh,
what
they
I mean?
Hear. Oh, that's they, the last.
That's, I hear that. So I actually kicked my aunts out at one point and I climbed up into the bed with her. Oh, now I'm going to cry. I climbed up into the bed with her. And I just had my time with her. You know, I just had the ability to say the things I wanted to say because I wasn't going to be there when she died. I knew that I wouldn't be able to make it. I was in California. I'd never make it in time. And, but I just climbed up into the bed to just say those things. And if she could hear me, then good. I wanted her to hear me. You know, forgiving her for things that she had done, which are pretty, you know, shitty things that maybe she had done, but just talking about all the memories of the things that we had, that was beautiful, you know?
The unfinished business.
Yeah, thank you. But we were at the tissue paper. Oh my God, okay, I'm just making a mess. There you go. I don't care. I'm going to need them all.
But that is important because that's part of what our hope is to help. I mean, I've been privy to trying to navigate that conversation, you know, with that, and then giving them the space, like the unfinished business that you need to say to your loved one.
I mean, absolutely.
It's so important.
I had had other things when she was more cognizant. I had had other things that were on my mind I needed to work through that I had carried in my life. And I went over there and I was like taking care of her a little bit. And I was like, hey, you know, I got two things I want to talk to you about, you know, this thing and this thing. And I remember talking to her about, and she was like mortified. Mm-hmm. She didn't remember either one of them. Absolutely mortified, and apologized. And there was something so, I was like, like the fact that she had forgotten that she did it was, I don't know, that was one thing. But the fact that she apologized even for it, for not remembering it, meant everything in the world, you know, to me. Mm-hmm. So that was just a, I'm just glad I had the chance to do that. I mean, and one of the things that we do here when we're doing therapy is trying to help people navigate their unfinished business. Mm-hmm. And there are other ways of doing it, even if the person's no longer with us.
That's absolutely right.
But to help, I mean, if hospice is part of, hey, let's talk about these kinds of things, at least it's out there and you guys are talking about things that maybe other people, their friends and family, are avoiding talking about. Mm-hmm. Or they're not coming around to be supportive, or, you know.
How do you process the unfinished business? Because having that talk is so hard.
Yes.
And not knowing where to begin. And I would often like guide people with just write a list of everything you want to say. I forgive you for, I thank you for. And what you just spoke to was so cathartic. They would come back and be like, this is everything that I didn't know I needed to be able to have that moment to express to them. And you don't think of it, because when you're in the moment, like you're so inundated with the death, with your grieving, anticipatory grief, all of these emotions. So sometimes it doesn't even cross people's minds, and you just need a little nudge, like, hey, it's okay to have this.
Yep. And that's where hospice and an anticipated death, it has a benefit to it, in that there's an opportunity to be directly with the person, to be able to say the things that you need to say, if they're capable of doing that. One of the things I think is, because it's a risk factor for prolonged grief disorder, is an inability to deal with that in unfinished business directly with the person while they're alive, and not being, you know, feeling unprepared and all the things that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then having to navigate that in your own way, or if you end up in therapy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, really just, I'm frustrated with hearing, I'm backtracking. I'm frustrated in hearing about how hospice is being forced to change over time.
I
have seen what has happened when people were not given the education they needed in order to not sit around and do if-onlys, what ifs to question. What if he was hurting, what I was doing was hurting him, and I wasn't picking up on the cues because nobody told me what to look for. So, you know, I was trying to put a pillow behind him, but maybe that was making things worse and I couldn't tell. And I didn't have anybody there say, hey, if you're starting to see this, you know, you might want to back this off. And she questioned it the whole time. And that was the other thing. He went on hospice home like 5 days and then he died. Like, what happened with the other 55 days?
The benefit.
The benefit period. Yeah. That's not 55 days. You know what I mean? 60. Out of 60.
So just like to explain.
6 months.
So 6 months is like the say, but we were talking earlier about Jimmy Carter and how he's the one who signed the act as president to have hospice care actually be something provided that we all are deserve it. We all deserve a dignified death.
Absolutely.
And he himself is on hospice and has entered his next benefit period. But that 5 days, you can't process all of those, all the things that are going on. Like, it's just probably, I mean, I don't know your situation, but for some people, hospice just comes in. It's just like a blindside, like blindsiding them. And so it's so difficult, and that it is really important to have those conversations. And that's why higher quality of care, lower patient caseloads, not overloading the nurses, making the money as the bottom line. Like, that's where things are being drawn towards, rather than having appropriate staffing needs. And you're going to burn out staff that also cannot give, and that just complicates things even further. So I don't know, there's so many things wrapped up into it that there's a reason, witnessing just in my 6 years there, I was in a chain, said this is not for me, went to a small local, saw the difference that it made with the nurses only having, you know, less patients and being able to provide what was needed. And it showed, like, when I would do support. And then when we got bought out by another big guy, having to revert back to that, I couldn't do it because the emphasis was more on something that people may not realize is that when you sign up as a primary, like when they ask for your information, you're going to get a survey from Medicare, and that's rating the hospice. The corporations will often drill in, how do we get the best survey score? How do we drop in these survey questions so that we can improve? A focus on the survey recipients rather than the survey recipient needs. Rather than thinking of them as people, as families that are grieving. And this is like a 40-page survey that gets mailed to them. Like, it's not an easy thing.
Hi, while you're grieving, here, fill out all this stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And it's just, and then the push for it, right? Like, that's the bottom line. Not attending to their needs. It started to pull. You felt the pull away from the roots of hospice philosophy. To what it's become,
right,
of a industry, death industry. That's honestly what I refer to it now. I mean, my hope is that
there is an industry there. There's an industry with crematoriums and funeral homes, and what can somebody?
we can go into our time.
I know. I'm starting to think about, like, we got a couple other things that we need to do episodes on. What can somebody expect once their loved one dies?
So are we talking like in terms of the hospice team? Okay.
And then like any aftercare that they may have rights to.
Right. So it depends if they're in the home or in the nursing facility, in the sense of what type of care that they will get. I'll explain this. So if they're at their home, I mean, regardless, like, we will attend the death, do postmortem care, you know, take med removal, whatever needs to be done, contact the funeral home, be present with family, provide the support that's needed.
At the funeral home?
Not at the funeral home, but wait till the funeral home gets there.
Right.
Typically, I don't advise people to be there for when the body's taken out, just because that's a horrible image for a multitude of reasons. But So, and then just kind of like providing support afterwards, like, because that's such a shocking moment. Many times, I mean, most of us, I feel like, can say it's a blur. We don't really remember that much of that actual moment when they died, except for they died, and then it's like a fog. In a skilled nursing facility, they may be pronounced and have postmortem care from those nurses, like from that staff, but we will still be notified, you know, and still attend to the family and do all of the follow-up. It's just a difference of home care versus being in a skilled nursing facility of who takes care of the pronouncement and the postmortem care. But the follow-up is still going to be from like a bereavement coordinator. My hope is, you know, I say this because every bereavement program is different, but it's supposed to be over 13 months that they're checking in with these families if they need counseling, if they need referrals out for extenuating bereavement needs, because bereavement in hospice is meant to be more of, let me think of how to phrase this, and I don't want to, because I don't want to say it wrong. How do you explain like a lower risk, not high acuity situation? Because the counseling is not supposed to be beyond 13 months, like we will, but if there's other issues going on, we will refer out to get additional level of care, because a lot of bereavement counselors, while they may have a background in, you know, like for instance, I have social work, your trainings, I can touch on this, that's not put into the hospice curriculum, right? Like
The grief.
the response. They even have sometimes volunteers making phone calls, like to families that aren't trained, like in that aspect. We do our bereavement training, but not, it's not nearly in depth of what, like, I feel like you've provided. I feel like I'm doing a prompt. Everybody watch Christina's 2-day workshop. but truly, it makes such a difference of knowing like what the bereavement process is about. And I feel like the bereavement counseling, it's a little more hesitant to dive deep, right? Like we will refer to therapy if we feel like there's underlying
So it's
things.
not so much about therapy.
Yes.
It's more about management
Yes, and
and like being able to ascertain that perhaps this person needs like a little bit more and make a refer, but being educated enough even to say, oh, I shouldn't go there. That person needs a little bit more. Let me get them out into the community and then get them out to the community resources, which is interesting because very rarely have we heard from hospices here. Like we've reached out to hospices and then not heard back from hospices. Yeah, I know. Like maybe this is something we should like think about here, you know, like saying, hey, or even funeral homes in the area or whatever. Like this is our gig. Like we're here for that. We're one of two organizations in Delaware, and the other organization is for kids and families. It's not even for like adults. Like how is that not, you know, known? So like for there's Delaware Hospice down the street.
Oh
I've
my
knocked on
gosh.
their doors. Nobody's there.
Right.
Like what's going on? So I'm hearing you say like people who are navigating helping families after the person has passed don't have the training because you're because they don't get training in school about grief, which I'm not going to get on that soapbox right now. That's a whole other, maybe I'll have my own little thing.
But you would think
But you
though
would think
that.
that they would have the basics to be able to say, I'm outside of my area of competency at this point. So I know that some people are trained on how to do that. Like if you're starting to see this, refer out to the, you know, community of where they can get the help that they need. But then the people who are doing, like, are they offering groups? Because sometimes you'll hear they are offering groups
Not all of them.
but not
Like,
all of them
yeah, so
also.
for instance, when I got, I would hold groups, but when our hospice was bought out, I was transitioned over to a large chain, like I mentioned, no groups, and not really an encouragement or promotion to do groups. And here's what I'll say. I feel like as a bereavement coordinator, our role was more so to navigate the grief process of validation that this is a normal response, because many people in the death avoidant culture don't understand that this is completely normal to be feeling
That's right.
all over the place and expect to be feeling fine in a month. And that's just unrealistic,
Right.
or 2 months, or whatever expectation you place on yourself. So it's a lot of just validation of this is a normal experience, and then creating for myself, like having the support group to be able to pull that in and validate that normalizing mm-hmm. experience. Not all bereavement programs do that.
Have groups.
Yeah, it's like at their discretion. Medicare will give you, they say you require a bereavement program, but they don't give you the stipulations of what's required in it, only that it has to be for 13 months. So you
can have this stuff, but what you have, we're not going to tell you what you need to have.
Like even COVID, there was a lot of restrictions, right, in place already, but the waiver for volunteers, I can't tell you how many people wrote that out so they don't have to get volunteers, like, and do the work for volunteer.
Oh my God.
I feel like I'm going to be on blast.
No, you're good. You know what? Like, if we do it, that'll be interesting to see what people, I'm very, very curious as to what you guys are going to, how you're going to respond to this, because are you experiencing this? Have you experienced this? What was that like for you to experience it? Are you getting some validation here on, you know, about this experience? I mean, these are important, you know, questions. And if you have experienced this, maybe if we could come together and build more of a community around mm-hmm. this kind of thing, we might be able to have some power to make some changes on different levels. Mm-hmm. So, and then there was one last thing I was going to ask you about hospice.
I wanted to circle back to...
Circle back.
Sorry.
No.
Because you mentioned about the dignity of like kind of choosing your right to die.
Yeah.
I don't know if you... Like New Jersey, this is like not hospice, but... Also, I agree with you on that because, as we've discussed, the trajectory, like how people die, is not always pretty.
Yeah.
And can even good deaths can present as scary because of how the body shuts down, what you see. Jersey has allowed like physician assisted suicide. Mm-hmm. And the progression towards that, I've had a lot of questions. How is that going to be implemented in hospice, having this autonomy?
Yeah.
Because a lot of them are already, like, they may be holding on for one thing or another, but it's not out of the realm more frequently people would have see that person they needed, even if they're not conscious, hear from them, have them in the room mm-hmm. past the next day or the 10 minutes that somebody leaves the room and they're alone.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I try to explain it, we come to this world alone. Sometimes we want to pass alone, right? Yeah. Like that's just part of like the natural cycle, but people will beat themselves up also for that. They should have, like you said.
I should have stayed in the room. Then he wouldn't have died alone. And was he scared when he died alone? Mm-hmm. And
so having physician... Like having that, they brought it to Pennsylvania as a bill proposed just recently. It's
proposed here in Delaware too.
It's working in the hospice world. I would just say I'm for it. Yeah. Like I really do.
And I can appreciate. And then that's like, we might need to write down a list of other ones we want to do because that one is going to fire people up because there's a lot of thoughts about that. You know, oh, they were suicidal before they got sick and now they want to die by suicide. And it's like, whoa. And, you know, how do we determine somebody is actually of sound mind enough to, mm-hmm. you know, to make that decision? And here I go, going, looking at my grandmother going, she knew she was dying. If she was in pain and she knew she was dying, did she have a right at that point to say, I have a right to die in the way that and the timeline that I want to die with the people around me to have that, you know, planned? Do I have a right to do that? And how is it that we are able to do that for animals, but we can't, which by the way, I've been through enough of that and they've ripped my heart out because my animals are my favorite people in my house, as I'm very clear about. Sorry, Jeff and the kids. I've also made a whole different note and then we're going to have to end here because it can keep going forever. I told the kids, and I think there's only going to be one of them that actually is going to listen to me because I think he's the one that likes me the best. Do not let me die anywhere but home. I want to die at home. I told my husband, I want to die at home. He says, can we not have this conversation? I'm like, no, because I could get sick tomorrow and we're going to have this conversation. The same reason why I have we have a will, you know, mm-hmm. and I can do the will. You're going to get a will because we are going to die and you don't know when. And when you have a brother who dies at 22, from a drug overdose, you don't know. So, but I've made him promise me, which is kind of suck for him. But I said, and once in a while, I go, what's the main promise that you're supposed to have for me, that you die in the house. I'm like, thank you. And don't let me die somewhere else.
It's important.
That's how I want to die. Yeah. It's in my home.
And I think
so that I can, you know, haunt them.
So you can haunt them. Sorry, that caught me.
That's like totally. But and I'm going to be very careful about what I'm wearing when I die, because that's going to be what I'm wearing when I'm dead. And then you know, and I've also told my best friend. I said, you know, if you're sitting around and whatever, and a book flies off the shelf, that's me. That's like our thing. That she's going to do that to me, and I'm going to do that to her. And I'd be like, hey, look, there is life after death.
There are so many things I could go into that. Like the book flying off the shelf, thing has happened.
Oh, I've had some really, we're going to do one on extraordinary experiences. I got a friend of mine who wrote a book on it. It was fan-freaking-tastic. And I
love that.
Near-death experience. I've had somebody who's had one of those. Okay, I'm getting sidetracked.
Love because I feel like it's touched on a lot of the benefit that we do for hospice and what we're trying, and that our intent and the people that are in it are in the right direction. However, I can't speak to what's going on up with the higher ups of what they're putting the strain on what is already an emotionally difficult for not only families, but also the staff that are mm-hmm. navigating these journeys mm-hmm. with these families on a daily basis, watching people die.
Yeah.
So
before we end today, mm-hmm. what do you think are three key takeaways that our listeners and viewers should get from this episode?
So first, I want to make it clear that if you have any questions or if you have any questions for your family members in regards to if they're eligible for hospice care, you can always contact your local hospice. They can begin the referral process to find out if they're eligible and do the evaluation. Another part I want to highlight is the importance of the support network. The support group aspect is very, I think, important to have notice, because it's not validated, I feel like, in our society enough, that grief is a normal reaction and the importance of support groups helping to validate that. And third, I really want to hone in on the philosophy of hospice was meant to be in its roots of volunteerism, everybody having a right to dignity to death, whether they're homeless, whether they're the richest person, we're all going to die, and returning back to those roots rather than a death industry approach of reaching a census of how many people we need as a business line rather than focusing on what end of life really means and supporting those that need it.
So I think we're going to have to wrap up on this topic of hospice. And our next topic that we're going to be talking about is for caregivers. Who are walking, you know, and facilitating and walking the path next to somebody as they are transitioning into their dying process, and the difficulties that mm-hmm. they experience and the joys that they can experience as well. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to all be a negative experience. Mm-hmm. So, but want to thank you so much for being willing to do this and talk about a topic that we're not talked about. Like, we should be talking about this shit in health class in high school. I mean, seriously.
Oh, yeah. I advocated in my grad school that it be implemented in our curriculum.
Not implemented.
It was an elective.
Social work. But it should. Okay, I'm not going
to. We're going to. Well, another episode.
A whole other episode about that as a professor. And advocacy on that kind of stuff. So
I agree.
But thank you so much again.
Thank you, Sam. For having
oh, my
me.
God. Thank you. And. All right. So as we wrap up today, if you have, I'm looking at the camera for those of you who are listening on YouTube, you have the ability to write some questions and comments underneath after having listened to the podcast. If you liked this one, you haven't listened to the other one, you can go dive into those. You can like and subscribe to this podcast, and you'll get, you know, once a week we drop a new episode. So, thank you for being here. And we're going to record another podcast here on caregivers. So you'll be able to see that drop in the future as well. All right. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it, subscribe, and leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. We want to be a resource for anyone who is experiencing loss, and this is a simple way you can help us spread the word. Check out our show description. There you'll find a link to connect with me on social media, as well as helpful articles and resources.